Yeah, so David J. Temple is probably not going to show up again today.
He's not coming?
That's the impression that I get. And so he asked us to record again.
Okay.
In his interest. Center for World Philosophy and Religion, content meeting, I don't know, whatever, 1,002.
Right. We've been doing this for a bunch of years.
So, yeah, now we're getting another record for David J. Temple, and wherever he is, may he receive this recording.
Yeah, yeah, I guess he needs it for the writing.
He needs it for the writing.
Okay. So maybe let's talk about attention.
Good.
Because we're right in the middle of writing on attention. So, and maybe, and I hope this works for David, we'll do it the way we've done it for the last, you know, 7-8 years or so, as, you know, I'll lay out a whole thing, you lay out a thing, just whatever's on our mind, you know, on attention. Okay?
Great.
So, you know, there's this movement to this attention economy that we're all familiar with, right? That in some sense you could say data is the new oil, and data is gained online through the grabbing of attention. So, you know, the online structure grabs attention, right? Or even hijacks attention. And that's the critique of the attention economy. And this is all stuff that, at least within a very small circle, people are familiar with. Right? There's been this grabbing of attention, this hijacking of attention, right? In order to keep people online and engaged. Engagement is a kind of euphemism for addiction, right? And so the business model of the attention economy is to keep people, you know, online, long-term, return repeat customers, you know, for as long as possible, for as much time as possible. And, you know, it took people a while to figure out why that was true. You know, when you read books like, even like Nicholas Carr's Shallows, 2011, or even Harari, you know, Yuval's book, you know, 21 Questions in 2017, they didn't actually get the business model straight. Their descriptions of the business model was wrong. They assumed this was in order to get more eyeballs for advertising,
Right. Which
is only one dimension. But we both understand, right, that, of course, the real issue is digital exhaust, right? And the real issue is gathering data, right, in order to create the possibility of micro-target personalization, you know, with all of its, you know, deleterious effects kind of undermining, you know, all these goods. So what I want to focus on is three things. First off, and this is the big problem, which we talked about 4 or 5 years ago when we started this techno-feudalism conversation. What's the problem with stealing attention? Who the fuck cares, right? So take attention, right? And we've talked to several people, you know, kind of who are key figures in the, you know, economic world and the libertarian world, who basically said, you know, this is you're taking people's attention. That's your right to do. So besides the fact that this is completely different than print or broadband advertising because it's micro-targeted and personalized and because you have the asymmetrical power of machine intelligence arrayed against you. Besides that distinction, which is of course true, right? There's a bigger issue at play, which is what is the actual problem in taking someone's attention? Why is that a problem? And when you read the people who are really some really good people, some that we know and like and love, right? Who have done fantastic work on pointing to the fact that, you know, you have this, you know, persuasive technologies lab, B.F. Foggs, and, you know, one of his students, you know, Nir Eyal, you know, writes his book Hooked, right? You know, which is all about the hijacking of attention. But in the great objections to it, no one actually tells you why it's a bad idea, right? There's this skirting around it. And that's true in surveillance capitalism and Zuboff's, you know, great work, but avoids what's the problem with stealing attention. But it's also true in a book like Stolen Focus by Hari, which is also a great book, great job, you know, in 2022, you know, and there's a whole other set of literatures. There's a book, Z, that we haven't gotten to talk about, called Thoreau's Axe by Caleb Smith at Yale, which is about attention. Another book by a woman named Kreiner called The Wandering Mind, right? And there's this whole slew of books, right? And there's another book called Loop, you know, by Ward, which kind of deals peripherally with this, but they're all kind of crying in different ways about attention. And they're saying you have to value attention. And I think the first thing that we want to say is that there's no reason to value attention ultimately unless attention is a value, right? There's no reason to value attention unless attention's a value. If attention's not a first principle and first value, there's no reason to actually be exercised at its violation. So I think that's the first thing, right? And in our equations, in our interior science equations that we formulated in cosmorotic humanism, there are three equations, one of them which explicitly talks about attention, which is the equation about the irreducible value of uniqueness. And uniqueness is both the unique quality of attention and your attention on that which is unique. That which is unique demands attention. And we have unique qualities of attention. And my unique quality of attention, right, is part of my unique personhood, right? Meaning I both demand in my unique personhood the unique attention of reality, right? The personal address of reality, and my irreducible uniqueness enacts my possibility of placing my unique attention on reality, right? So attention is an intrinsic part of uniqueness. It's an intrinsic part of the core quality of Eros and in the Eros equation, which is the experience of radical aliveness in the equation, desiring ever deeper contact, which involves the placing of attention, right? And ever greater wholeness, right? The placing of attention, separate parts place attention on each other, right? And then generate something larger. And finally, the intimacy equation, right? Intimacy equals shared identity in the context of relative otherness, right? Shared identity, but that comes from mutuality of recognition. We place attention in each other. Mutuality of pathos. We feel each other. Mutuality of value, right? We place attention and, or we speak from within a field of shared value. And then mutuality of purpose. We place attention on an intention. So attention is this core structure of cosmos. So I think, and let me just say one last thing and give it to you, right? Right? Which is we have to reclaim the first principle and first value of attention, A. B, we can't do that without first principles and first values. Without there being a first principle and first value, there's nothing that's being violated, right? You know, C, right, it's implicit in uniqueness, in Eros, in intimacy, but really in everything, right? In other words, all of the equations assume, right, the first principle and first value of attention. By saying first principle and first value of attention, what we mean is that attention itself is a quality of Eros of love. It's a quality of cosmos. And that attention goes all the way down. And then in some sense, protons, neutrons, and electrons place attention on each other, right? And all the way up the evolutionary chain, right, there is this increasing process of attention until we get to the human level, the depth of the self-reflective human. And the self-reflective human is the history of humanity, is the history of the evolution of attention, right? And so maybe last piece, we could actually look for a second, right, at pre-modern, modern, post-modern, right, just in terms of attention. So the pre-modern mind places attention, but it places attention for the sake of a religious action, which is usually some form of union with the divine. So I have to place my attention in order to create union, right? In order to kind of not be distracted by this world, right? The modern world kind of rejects that. Modernity rejects that for partially right and partially wrong reasons. And modernity places attention on the sciences. Let me place attention on the natural world, right? Let me measure the natural world, which is a way of place measurements, a form of attention. And let me place attention interiorly on my own psychology. So there's this movement of attention. And then post-modernity comes along and says, actually, there's nothing really to place attention on, right? That's why the attention economy emerges out of this post-modernity, because nothing's actually real.
Who cares? Right.
Who cares? Like, what's there to actually place attention on? So therefore, the post-modern mind is exteriorized in the structure of the internet, right? In which there's complete interrupting of attention, right? The structure of the internet is the scattering of attention in every moment because attention is no longer a value, right? The process of attention read is no longer a value. Then post-postmodernity, in this new world, in this new story of value in response to the meta-crisis, we're saying, no. Actually, attention's at the very center, because that's the center of ethos. It's the center of anthrontology. The ability to turn inward and place attention on my interior, right, actually is the way that I actually impact, that I actually formulate ethos. It's the way I formulate law, because actually the mysteries are within us. Infinity is within us. We participate in the field, and that participation happens through the placing of attention. So we actually reclaim attention in this very, very dramatic new way, right? Emergent from the best strains, I would say, in pre-modernity and modernity. Okay, that's a little bit of a, takes us into attention.
Get it going.
It's exciting.
It's exciting. And the idea that the cosmos or the universe values attention, right? So that evolutionary morphology, that evolution itself moves towards structures that have more capacity for attention, right? And so this was part of Teilhard's hypothesis about cerebralization. The idea that, like, if you look at the evolutionary record, it's building bigger and bigger nervous systems, and it's making the organisms dependent upon the ability to pay attention or die. It's one way to think about it. So, like, even from the perspective of neo-Darwinian evolution, you get a situation where the organism's ability to pay attention to its environment is the thing that gives it selective advantage.
Yeah, beautiful.
And it didn't have to be that way. Right. So there's plenty of processes in the cosmos that work really well without things that look from our perspective like a lot of attention being paid to them. And even like insects are an interesting example where the amount of attention that an individual ant can pay as opposed to the total unified attention, let's say, marshaled by the entire ant colony. Right. And then you get the attention of a single hunting lioness, right, watching for hours the gazelle pack to look at the one who's injured, to wait for the right moment, right? So there's like all of these places in biology where the attentiveness of the organism itself is what is selected for evolutionarily. So we look at a situation where we're growing these organisms and they're adapting to become more attentive. And then, of course, you get the human. And in the human, and this is where I'll start looking at books, you look at the work of Michael Tomasello, who is a comparative psychologist at the Max Planck Institute, and he's looking back at the American pragmatist tradition, and specifically George Herbert Mead. George Herbert Mead was one of the first people to talk about semiotics. He picked it up from Peirce, and he was talking about the fact that we use signs in a way that other animals don't, right? So one of the things animals pay attention to and have to pay attention to are the signs that their species put out. Mating signs are the most classic ones, but also hunting signals from pack animals that coordinate, and then the signs that other animals leave. And then, of course, the vocalizations of animals are essential to their living. We vocalize in a very different way, and it has to do with this, what's called the joint attentional situation, which is the way that we attend to together, not attend alone, one-on-one with an object, but attend to me and you looking at this thing together. So the joint attentional situation allows us to understand our complex vocalizations in a much more dramatic and useful way than any other vocalizations that animals make, right? And there's a whole field of sociology called symbolic interactionism that emerges from this approach, and Tomasello locks in, but basically he proves that, like, listen, monkeys don't do this. No other animals do this. Humans spend a tremendous amount of time in very complex joint attentional situations where we kind of like are able to create and draw from and learn from the world together in real time. And one of the main places that happened is in intergenerational transmission. So that's, you know, the kids with the elder, sitting down, exploring the world together, holding attention together for an extended period of time while looking at how a tool is made, or holding attention together for a long time while looking at how food is prepared. And so what Thomas L. is basically saying is that there's many traits that humans share with other animals. But if you're looking for those traits that might be the ones that are candidates for the differentiators, the traits that we have that could explain the difference, the obvious difference, like we build hospitals and other animals don't build hospitals and we go to the moon and all of that, right? So how does that all get started? His argument is that it has to do with this capacity for joint attention, which he doesn't say, but which what I would say, which is the outcome of a universe which is pushing towards greater and greater capacity for more and more intimate and complex forms of attention. And so the idea that the distinctly human thing, which would give rise to what we think of as language and story, which would just say, so me and you together looking at the world, what do? We tell a story about the world. Or me and you together talking about other people. So the equally primordial emergence of humanness with language, story, and joint attention. That's what Thomas L. is basically proposing. And we're proposing that more or less also, saying that, listen, one reason strongly to say that you have to value attention, that it is not a secondary quality of the universe, right? That's basically what they're arguing. So like most technologists wouldn't say you could ignore gravity and they wouldn't say you could ignore the laws of thermodynamics or you could ignore the laws of electromagnetism.
Right.
These things you respect. But the idea that there are limits on human nature, that there are ways that the human mind, psyche, soul works, which if you transgress or trespass certain limits, it won't work anymore. You can break it. Just like you can exhaust natural resources, you can exhaust all available attention. And just like you can cross thresholds with pollution, you can cross moral or ethical thresholds. So it's just putting on the table. And then I'll throw it back to you.
That's great.
That indeed the universe does seem to be pushing towards attention. The human being, in one sense, what defines us as human is a unique capacity for a certain type of attention. And so therefore, the preying upon or degrading that very thing which separates us, separates us and unites us to the universe. Because through the joint attention, we can tell more complex stories about the universe and understand it better. So you're tinkering with something very, very fundamental when you're tinkering with attention, akin to a law of nature. And so to devalue attention in the human is to transgress. It's basically to push against the flow of the universe, is to say. We don't value what the universe values. And
So please. No, it's great. I want to come back to joint attention because that's so big. Because joint attention, as you described it, is an expression of how this quality of attention, which we're now establishing as a first principle and first value of cosmos, emerges uniquely at the human level.
Right.
As we point out in the, in lots of our conversations, and I think, David talks about this in the First Principles and First Values book, right? That every first principle and first value, I think he writes, has continuity and discontinuity.
Right.
So continuity is attention all the way up and all the way down. Mm-hmm. And then there's unique qualities of attention that emerge at each level. So let me just kind of go back for a second, just kind of riff with you for a second. So one of the things that David talks about there is that, and we've talked about it many times, is that you only arouse, what Zuboff calls appropriately astonishment and outrage.
Right.
If you're violating a value, or you arouse communion, you arouse political will, moral will, economic will, if you're going to support a value. And this is exactly what we're pointing to.
Right.
So if attention is not a value of cosmos, there's absolutely no reason that you should be concerned with its hijacking. And indeed, the entire structure of techno-feudalism basically says, well, there's no law against this. Law, as we've talked about many times, has gotten dissociated from value.
Right.
And so why not do it? So that's kind of one, right? But let's go even deeper. It's very beautiful, right? Which is that the very nature of reality itself and the interior sciences, and you can get a deep sense of this realization in your own interiority, anthro-ontologically, right? By anthro-human ontologically, right? As we always say, right? For realness, you can get this, you can get an interior sense of this. What reality is that the infinite places attention, and that placing of attention manifests the finite. So really, when you read, for example, Genesis, wow. Vayar,
right.
Divinity looked at, divinity placed infinity, placed attention on the finite. And, you know, we're trying to formulate together, brother, this, you know, whenever you do a new story of value, you want to articulate a new world religion as a context for our diversity, you have to try and find in your own realization the new name of God. So we've talked about this new name of God together as God is the infinite intimate. And what the infinite intimate means is that the infinite is being intimate, meaning the infinite is placing attention. So attention is an act A of intimacy. It's an act of eros, right? In other words, one. Two, it's a creative act, right? Attention blooms reality. It manifests reality. Attention births. And really, when you think about it, what is the act of loving? Right, to love someone is to place my attention on them, right? And, you know, we talk about a lot in cosmorotic humanism, you know, we try and distinguish between love and sexuality and eros, and our point is that it's really not about sex, that the sexuality models the erotic, right? In what sense? Because sexuality is the placing of attention. That's what it is, right? So that's a very... Right, we begin to get this notion that love and attention, love and creativity and attention are actually utterly related to each other, mm-hmm. right? Inextricably related, and that all of personhood and all of intersubjectivity is about the unique placing of attention. So if we actually hijack attention, we're actually deconstructing the very interior structure of reality.
Hmm. Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a couple things
please.
To say. Just to get the continuity-discontinuity thing in a couple of ways. So, and early evidence that attention goes way down. So plants, right? Plants attend to the sun and to moisture in the soil. The roots grow in the direction of moisture. Leaves and whole structures of, you know, 1,000-pound limbs will reorient to the sun, right? And there are some plants that do it drastically, where they come out and they close again and they come out. And so there's an attentiveness that the plant has. But then, of course, it doesn't have a nervous system. And it certainly doesn't have the things that we most associate with attention, which are eyeballs, right? So there's like a whole world of attention in the universe, which includes like jellyfish and other mm-hmm. stuff, which do not have eyeballs, but which are constantly attending to the world, right? Now, then you get this whole world of things with eyeballs that are looking at stuff.
Right.
And that's what we associate with attention. Pay attention, like wake up, like open your eyes. So there's this whole world of attention with eyeballs, right? And just to get that, that's an example of continuity and discontinuity, right? You turn, there's the turning towards, there's the attending to, there's the moving towards, but then there's the having visual capacity, which opens up this ability to be intimate with things that are much farther away in one sense, or at least to see these things. And so it's just worth noting is that we live in this world of attention where it's eyeballs and eyeball capturing. But that's stacked on top of this whole complex compound individual of attention that goes back down to the responsiveness of the plant tissues. And that's just kind of gorgeous just to sit in
there. Yeah.
And you have that whole stack. So like your body is responsive at the level of the plant to the sun, and you get goosebumps and things occur that you can't even control in your body that have to do with your body attending to itself or the environment. So that kind of continuity of attention is kind of a way of thinking about the spectrum of consciousness, and the differences that move with the different types of affordances that the organisms evolve. And many people think when they think of the plant turning towards the sun, the instinct is that the plant loves the sun. This is the way you describe the plant turning towards the sun, and the way many things attend towards things, it is as if they, is as if through that attention. So,
yeah, no, it's beautiful. It's so beautiful.
I want to make one
please
final point, which is just to maybe to complexify it a little bit. So then you get the digital, right? And so there's the whole digital capturing our eyeballs, which is great. But then there's the digital has eyeballs. So sensors, sensor networks. And what's weird about this is that there's a way that something can be reliably differentially responding. So it's a sensor, but it's actually not
paying attention.
It's not attending to you.
Right.
Right. And this is very important to get this distinction. It's a subtle philosophical distinction, and it's made in Brandom, and it's made in Sellers and a couple other analytical philosophers. And it became part of the philosophy of mind and up into cognitive science. But the difference between an attending being and a reliably differentially responding sensor is something that needs to be worked at. So imagine you go to a door, right? And it's one of those doors where as you approach it, it's got a sensor and the door opens, right? Another door, you walk towards it and a human being opens it for you.
Not the same.
Not the same. In one sense, identical. Especially if that guy's hired to do that. And every time you walk towards a door, he does it exactly the same way. In one sense, the same. And in one sense, not the same at all. And so this is the case as well with, let's say, a chatbot. All right. The experience of being in conversation with someone, even on text, when you know it's another human and it's the dot, 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 they're texting you, is the experience of their paying attention to me.
Right.
The experience of being on with a chatbot is the experience of something paying attention to you when actually nothing is paying attention to you. You're dealing with a reliably differential responder, but not an actual attending being, right? You're dealing with a language bot, but not a language user. All right. So just kind of throwing.
Yeah. Yeah. No. I mean, it's the difference between a stalker and a lover, right? In some sense, right? You know, and it's every move you make, every breath you take, I'll be watching you.
Right.
But that's exactly not placing attention. And it's paradoxically there. It looks like I'm placing attention, but actually I'm not. It's not, the placing of attention is intimate. And intimate means we have a shared identity. There's a context of otherness in the intimacy equation that's laid out in the First Principles and First Values book. And then there's a mutuality of recognition. There's a mutuality of feeling, right? There's a mutuality of value. There's a mutuality of purpose. So surveillance and stalking, right, is not the placing of attention. The placing of attention is by its nature, the Hebrew word for attention is sim lev. It's in the army. Attention, right? Attention means something of gravitas is happening. So sim lev means the placing of the heart.
Totally. But a hunter hunting and...
Well, so hunting's not stalk, right? In other words, the hunter in the best sense of the word. So in other words, not the hunter who's, you know, hunting for kind of, you know.
No, but even unethical attention is attention. I mean, it's not that the only time we call something attention is when it's the right type of attention.
That seems let's think about it for a second, right? So love and attention are kind of inextricably bound up at their best, right? So love can be distorted. So for example, when love gets distorted, it becomes hate. Hate actually has an obsessive placing of attention, right? So it actually paradoxically is, it is a kind of obsessive attention. So I guess we could talk about the stalker as a kind of, but it's precisely an objectifying when you can't be felt. When someone places attention on you, And that placing of attention is an expression of eros, because that's, because attention and eros are intimately related. Then you're bloomed. It's why we feel violated by surveillance, because it's actually it's a distortion, a degrading of the quality of attention, which is by its nature intersubjective, meaning I'm actually feeling you. I'm actually, right? So when infinity places attention on reality, it's an attention which is an erotic attention, right? Its insides are aligned with love. It's an intimate erotic universe. When that attention is hijacked and distorted, so for example, that's exactly what you were saying before. So when you're being surveilled, when you're not only looking at the internet, but the internet's looking at you, right? And it's a machine being. So we'd say that's not attention, right? When a human being is obsessively looking at you, so, and it's for the sake of killing you, right? Or it's a stalker, or it's a, right? So what we're actually saying is there's something deficient in the quality of attention. Meaning, if you were really paying attention, you would actually see my interiority. If you're really paying attention, you wouldn't be reducing and objectifying me. You wouldn't be degrading me. So you're paying a level of attention. You're seeing something about me, but you're actually not placing full attention, right? In other words, the act of, for example, demonization, Joseph Burke points out in his book, Tyranny of Malice, right? That the way malice works is you place attention, but it's distorted attention where you kind of identify, you know, some deficiency in the object of your attention. Then you magnify it, distort it. Then you occlude from your field of attention all of the good, right? And that becomes hatred. And so it's a hatred is a degraded form of attention. Something like that.
Something like that. Yeah. And that's all attention paid by humans to other humans.
Right.
And then there are the sensor networks where you have whole complex things happening without any human in the loop. And so I think this is one of the important things to think about with the what's wrong about this, or the framing of surveillance is, and the reason we would not succeed with some techno-feudalists and raising the argument, because they'd be like, but it's not that. It's not that there's someone looking at you. It's precisely no one looking at you. It's just like the door opening when you leave the grocery store. It's just a sensor. There's nobody looking in your house or looking over your shoulder at your web browsing. No one ever will. There's millions of people doing it. How could we possibly look at your web browser?
Right.
It's just an algorithm that happens to know everything about you well enough to advertise to you and to direct your behavior and all of that stuff. So the creepiness factor of surveillance, the idea that the KGB is tapping your phone or they're looking in through here with binoculars or something like that, that's actually not what's occurring.
Right.
And that's important to get, which is why the frame of surveillance, I think, is less useful than the frame of operant conditioning chamber.
Right.
Which of
Skinner's
course,
box.
Which of course involves surveillance.
Right.
But a whole bunch of other stuff. And so the idea that the apparatus is surveilling you, yeah, but it's not actually creepy in that sense. It's creepy because it's controlling your behavior. It's shaping your preferences. And it's degrading your attention to the point where you don't even know that it's degrading your attention.
So this is very, very important, actually. This distinction between, and it's a distinction that we've talked about a lot, between surveillance being the problem, which is actually itself problematic, and it's one of the reasons it's ignored by techno-feudalism.
Because it's not your dad's surveillance, right?
It's not that kind of surveillance that you're describing. Right. And it also can be munificent, right? In other words, so let me just go slow for a second. So surveillance is a form of attention in that, right, the surveillance that happens through the first wave and second wave AI, but let's just say first wave AI social media, you know, being fed into machine intelligence, right, and then being turned into data, right, and then, you know, the Internet of Things, you know, and the ability to kind of turn what they call dark data into kind of usable data, right? Which then creates this kind of personality profile about you. That is actually, right? That is actually an evolution in the structure of reality, and that it allows reality to pay attention to you in a way that you are actually unaware of in a certain way. And it could do that, right? In a very, very benign way, right? We're concerned with existential risk, and we're concerned, and we need to actually, as Bostrom says in the Vulnerability Hypothesis 2019, we need to keep our eyes on everyone because we're afraid of a particular kind of black ball that can actually be wildly destructive. So we do surveillance within the context of first values and first principles, right? In other words, we're not looking to control you, right? We're just simply creating a thing which is held by some sort of responsible structure in order to, you know, be aware, right? You know, if there's actual existential threats that are actually real, that'd be one. So I'm doing this limited surveillance, right? Limited in what I do with it, right? For the sake of love, of eros, of protection, right? Of et cetera. A Skinner's box, an operant conditioning chamber, meaning I'm paying attention to you in order to manipulate you, right? And as I focus on everything that's observable about you in order to create a pattern which allows me to control you, so that is attention, right, which fundamentally degrades.
It does. I mean, I would, and we need to wrap here, but I would go so far as say that no one's paying attention to you. In the operant conditioning chamber. That's the saddest.
No one's paying attention to you.
To you. That's the saddest,
right,
thing.
That goes back to what we said before,
saddest,
right?
That's the saddest thing about it.
Right.
In fact, only if you were important enough to actually be surveilled.
Right.
But you're not. Right. You're not. You're basically an anonymous, predictable agent within a system of control, being treated as a class of person. And so therefore there isn't anyone anywhere.
It's the opposite of divine providence.
It's the opposite of divine providence.
Precise opposite.
Where they're paying attention to every hair in your head. Now, the irony is that you're being surveilled to the level of every hair
right.
in your head. And yet there's no one actually watching.
Right.
So this is where it gets kind of weird. Right? So we just went into like a dark mirror
episode. Yeah, went into a dark mirror. And this is the God's eye view.
Right.
That's described by the MIT Media Lab and by Skinner,
yeah.
Which is digital omniscience, which is the precise flip opposite of providence.
Exactly. So digital omnipotence, in which there is no actual care or attention being paid.
There's no infinity of intimacy.
There's no infinity of intimacy. There's an infinite absence of intimacy.
Right.
Presence of control and manipulation. And so that's terrifying. So they capture your attention, isolate you, don't pay attention to you while simultaneously manipulating and controlling behavior. And the way the whole thing hinges is the vulnerability of the attentional system to capture. So this is back like full circle. Evolution built this incredibly complex thing, which was built to like be hyper aware and attend to its environment. And then we spent billions of dollars figuring out how to hack that thing to capture the attention, to make it manipulable. So that notion of hyperstimulus, as you already mentioned, you know, basically engagement as a euphemism for addiction.
Right.
A whole bunch of things that are going on here, which are leveraging the beauty of what evolved as the most complex attending organism is just being... Yes, degraded is too weak of a word when you think about what's happening to the youth in particular with regards to the addictiveness and stickiness of the technology.
Right, so. The utter, right. So I know we have to wrap here. So this is the last point on my side, which is, and yes, yes, and yes, which is, something which is of value, I have a need for, right? So, and I desire. So there's a first value and first principle of eros. So I need eros. I have a fundamental set of eros needs, and I desire eros. I have a need for intimacy. I desire intimacy. I have a need for uniqueness. I desire uniqueness. I have a need for transformation. I desire transformation. So attention, which is built into all of these, right? So I have a need for attention. I have a need to be personally addressed by cosmos, right? And anthrontologically, that's how I know that I am personally addressed, right? In other words, when there's a fundamental need to be personally addressed, there's a fundamental, I mean, and maybe to close here on my side, which is, you know, you remember that line in, it just comes to line we read in high school when we were reading Arthur Miller, right? And, you know, Willie Loman's wife in Death of a Salesman, right? She says, attention must be paid, right? So we have a fundamental need for attention, not because we're psychologically, you know, somehow degraded. No, but because the essential nature of reality is that the placing of attention on us and our capacity to place attention in a way in which we're not degraded. We have that capacity to place attention, which is basically the need to be loved and the need to love. That is a fundamental human value. And to degrade that is the death of our humanity. That's the death of humanity. Right. So that's a big deal.
Yeah. All right. On the record for David.
On the record for David.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good.
Yo.